This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As new candidates enter the 2016 presidential race on what seems like an hourly basis, the flood of stump speeches and political rhetoric can be overwhelming. It can be challenging to parse out exactly what these presidential hopefuls are actually saying. For example, if a candidate were to say that they are a proud member of America's longest-standing civil rights organization, the translation is they're a member of the NRA, or National Rifle Association. If a candidate is asked about their record in the private sector running a business and they mention they were responsible for initiating a career alternative enhancement program, well, that means they just laid off or fired a good portion of their employees. Here to help translate the modern world of doublespeak is Christopher Cerf. He's co-author of Spinglish, the Definitive Dictionary of Deliberately Deceptive Language. Christopher is an author, composer, and record and television producer, and a founding contributor to National Lampoon. He's also one of the creators of the PBS series Between the Lines. Christopher, great to have you with us.
Well, it's great to be here, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
So should we trust anything you say since you're so fluent in Spinglish?
Probably not. I don't even trust myself anymore.
Well, how do you define Spinglish?
Well, Henry Beard, my co-author, and I define it really as any language that is intentionally deceptive. In other words, it sounds like the person uttering these remarks or writing them is saying one thing, when they're really saying something else that's intended to take advantage of you. Though, of course, you can do this too. And we have a section in our book where we go from English to Spinglish so we can help you deceive others.
Well,
if that's
great.
What you want to do.
Good to know. Well, politicians are fluent in Spinglish, as we mentioned, but don't have a monopoly. Are there other especially offending Spinglish-savvy professions?
Well, there are quite a few. Obviously, the world of business, which you mentioned in your intro, is filled with corporations trying to sound like they're doing something good when they're not. Marketing and advertising and public relations, people have been doing this for decades. Then there's a little subsets of all those, like the real estate industry is notorious for using spin in all their ads.
So what would be some examples?
Well, if you read that a house you might want to buy is cozy or adorable, you can be sure that it's absolutely tiny, too small to get into. And a house that's labeled a project or a wonderful fixer-upper is a total dump. Or if they tell you that the house has easy access to some exciting area, like a city, you can be sure it backs up to a freeway entrance.
And one of a kind, what does that mean?
One of a kind means that it has such a weird, eccentric floor plan that it's probably a hopeless place to live.
Well, we've certainly seen many examples in business. Can you give us some of those corporations that might be trying to create a more positive spin?
Well, there's so many, from HSBC to Citibank, that I don't even know where to begin. But a lot of the spin they've been creating over the last few years is either to mask terrible financial results. For example, they might say, we had a great year of negative growth, which means obviously that they lost money. Or they can say they're highly leveraged, which means they're hopelessly in debt. But even more important, the CEOs are often, because they've misrun the companies in many cases, forced to lay off or fire people, as you mentioned earlier. So there are all kinds of ways companies can say that. One of the best known, but also one of the most evil terms is right-sizing. That sounds like the company's really doing something great, mm-hmm. but it actually means they laid off most of their employees.
So many euphemisms for firing somebody. My favorite, I think, in your book was involuntarily leisured.
Yes, I totally love that one. And also offering someone a career change opportunity, which I think came from either your state, New Hampshire, or Vermont. And I think that's a beauty.
Well, there are loads of different opportunities to notice Spanglish. I noticed a lot in the food industry. Chilean sea bass, actually Patagonian toothfish, thoughtfully renamed by a fish wholesaler. And canola oil, what's the family-friendly name for?
Well, it used to be called rapeseed oil, but
not pleasant
found,
rapeseed.
For some reason, that wasn't selling quite as well as they hoped, so they just renamed it.
So what are some other foodie examples?
I think the orange roughy is a fish that was originally called a slime fish. Which would you rather order? And baby carrots is an interesting one. There used to be a lot of waste when carrots were packaged for sale in grocery stores because they threw away all the misshapen ones or the lumpy ones. And all of a sudden, a food wholesaler got the idea that if you just cut all those misshapen ones up into tiny little pieces and called them baby carrots, they might sell. And it worked incredibly well. The sales went up like 10% right away of carrots in America.
Well, that seems like a pretty clever use of Spanglish. I mean, it's not always a bad thing, is it?
Well, no, unless the carrots weren't good. And in that case, you're quite right. It was clever. A lot of these are clever, actually. Getting back to politics for a minute, there's some incredibly clever terms that have made things that you might not like sound good.
Such as?
Like revenue enhancement. That sounds like a good thing to do in your budget, but it actually means raising taxes. But of course, if you want to cut taxes and at the same time cut welfare and policies and health policies and things that help people, you could say you want to institute pro-growth tax policies. That just means cutting taxes for the rich, really.
Well, when you think of, you know, changing the name of Slimehead or Rapeseed, it implies that the American consumer actually likes to or maybe needs to be deceived. Is that true?
Well, I don't know that they'd like to be deceived. They want to hear good news, certainly. But I don't think they want to be told fake news or cajoled into doing something they really wouldn't do if they knew better. The advertising industry has all kinds of terms that help you do that. For example, you might hear that that a sale is on and the discounts are up to 80%. Well, that might mean that one item in a huge store is at 80%, but everything else could be 1%. You just don't really know. Or you could hear that something is for sale for a fraction of its former price, but that could be 99/100 of its former price, but that's still a fraction.
Well, I see there is a seal that doesn't quite look like the Pulitzer Prize seal on your book.
Well, yes, that's actually, if you don't look closely, you might think it's the Pulitzer Prize. I would understand you're making that mistake, Virginia, but it's actually the Pulitzer Prize. And you might notice that Benjamin Franklin on the medal has a rather long nose.
I did notice
Pinocchio-like.
That.
And the motto of the Pulitzer Prize organization, by the way, is Stercus Tori, which actually means bullshit in Latin.
We're speaking with Christopher Cerf about his new book. It's called Spanglish, The Definitive Dictionary of Deliberately Deceptive Language, which he co-wrote with Henry Beard. I'm just thinking of different ways that political parties especially use opportunistic language to kind of degrade the other side. The death tax is one of those things that comes to me. An easy way of putting a bad spin on any kind of inheritance tax or what would be another
just
one?
Just before you leave that topic, beyond the death tax, it's also called the wealth tax when you think that it should be imposed on people who are very rich and can afford it. So that spins both ways.
But don't you think that we as voters, consumers, are smart enough to figure this kind of stuff out?
You might think so, but often it's cleverer than you think. A great example is the evolution of the terms for torture. We never want to, or American government certainly never wants to say that it tortured anyone. So they invented the term enhanced interrogation techniques. But unfortunately, they found out that people began to see through that one, so they just abbreviated it to EITs. Now, if you hear me talk about EITs on the radio, that'll just go right by you most of the time. You'll say, what the heck does that mean, if you even notice the term? So actually, the linguist Steven Pinker came up with the term euphemism treadmill because you often have to keep making up new euphemisms because the old ones wear out when people catch on to them.
Hmm. So people tend to need a little bit of evaporated cane juice, a spoonful of sugar.
Well, that's a beautiful one. I mean, people don't think about that when they see it in a list of ingredients. But of course, evaporated cane juice, if you do think about it, is just sugar.
Well, then on this idea of the treadmill, has the art of spin become more prevalent in the age of the 24-hour news cycle, do you think?
I really do, for a lot of reasons, partly because there's so much more news or what passes for news. There's a lot more opportunity to be attacked or misunderstood or to be found out. A famous example of that is when George Allen was running for Senate in Virginia a few years ago for re-election, I think. There was something famous called the macaca moment,
right,
when he used the word macaca, thinking no one was taping him. But actually, the rival campaign had sent someone to tape him. That never used to happen before we had the 24-hour news cycle or the internet. Then he had to explain all that.
Right.
And
he
actually
was describing
cost him the election.
Describing an Indian-American, I think.
That's
in the
right.
Audience.
That's right.
Christopher, do you think English is an especially good vehicle for doublespeak?
It is. Henry Beard, my colleague, has really thought about that a lot, and we wrote about it in our introduction. One reason that it is it's a mixture of both Latin words and Anglo-Saxon words, and they're both useful for different purposes. You can make these very fancy phrases out of Latin that sound much more innocent than the Anglo-Saxon equivalents. For example, if you say that a statement is inoperative or that you're engaging in terminological inexactitude, that sounds a lot better than admitting you're lying. But of course, sometimes spin is meant to make things sound worse than they really are. That's when short, blunt words like Anglo-Saxon words can come in very handy. Another great term for lying, by the way, is reality augmentation. Or correcting the historical record is another thing that was said after the Iran-Contra scandal. What that meant was they just destroyed all the documents that agreed with the charges.
Well, Christopher Cerf, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it was great to be here. Thanks.
Christopher Cerf is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, or co-author, along with Henry Beard, of Spinglish, the Definitive Dictionary of Deliberately Deceptive Language. Also founding contributor to National Lampoon, and one of the creators of the PBS series Between the Lions. You find a link to more on the books and more examples of Spinglish at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Over time, some Spinglish words evolved to take on the very meanings they were originally used to avoid, especially when it comes to describing economic or financial trouble. Producer Don Hill has more.
In the 19th century, a ship loaded with precious metal from the California goldfields was on its way to New York City and Wall Street. Unfortunately, the boat sank to rise no more, and that triggered what newspapers called the Panic of 1857. As a correspondent for the New York Tribune, Karl Marx was inspired by the fiscal chaos, describing it as a capitalist crisis. Words really matter in the financial press, and any talk of a panic or crisis in the late 19th century was sure to set off one. So the word depression was substituted as a kinder, gentler description for an economic slowdown. The idea being a depression was like a dip in the road. You'd hardly notice it. That seemed to do the trick at the beginning of the Great Depression, but by 1934, it was clear the rocky road ahead was more than a speed bump. Aldous Huxley, the writer who wrote The Doors of Perception, and yes, that's the book the Lizard King, Jim Morrison, read, recoined the word depression as more accurately a recession.
Producer Don Hill there, remembering how the word panic was used in place of depression and later recession, which in itself became a pretty problematic term. In the 1970s, a spokesman for the Carter administration was criticized for using the R word and later avoided the issue by referring to the flagging economy as a banana. By now, breweries all across the country have rolled out their summer seasonals, usually lighter, more citrusy brews. Among them is Blue Moon's Honey Wheat variety, which, like all of the beers from the Blue Moon Brewery, has the homey motto, artfully crafted. But that does not mean it meets the criteria for a craft beer. Blue Moon is, in fact, made by the industry giant Miller Coors, and for that reason is the target of a recently filed class action lawsuit alleging that Blue Moon is being falsely marketed as a craft beer. To find out more, producer Taylor Quimby got in touch with Stephen Beaumont, co-author of The World Atlas of Beer and the new Pocket Beer Guide 2015.
This is a lawsuit that really stems out of what's been going on for a while now in the spirits world. There have been several suits carried lately, most notably against Tito's Vodka, which attests that what they're saying on the packaging isn't actually true in terms of it being handcrafted or artisanally made or things like that. I think that this is just somebody who saw the opportunity on the beer side and said, well, you know, I'm going to get into this lawsuit and see if anything comes of it because they're doing it on the spirit side of things.
And this history, as I've read it, almost sounds like one of mild embarrassment, which is that he got into an argument with somebody, maybe family members, saying that, no, Blue Moon really is a craft beer, and then was somewhat shocked to find out that, well, it's not.
Of course, that begs the question, what is a craft beer? If I was able to answer that question, I think I'd be doing extremely well. it is a challenge. People have tried to answer it. We spent 4 pages in the World Atlas of Beer trying to answer it. I think maybe it just comes down to this: craft beer is what you feel craft beer is.
So you're saying that there's no legal framework, that a craft brewery can only be so large or can only produce in some certain way?
There is a definition that is offered by the Brewers Association of the United States, and that has several different production and technique definitions in it. Interesting to note, however, that definition continues to change as they try to grow the craft beer tent. So, maximum amount of production has gone steadily up. And allowable production techniques have changed because as breweries get larger, they naturally have to do things a bit differently.
Yeah, more automation, I would think.
Absolutely. I was just down a couple weeks ago at the new Sierra Nevada Brewing Company brewery in Asheville, North Carolina, and it is a $120+ million facility. They are very, very technically focused, and there's still people there. I mean, it's not all done by machinery, but is it what people have in mind when they think, oh, it's a handcrafted beer?
Right.
Probably not.
There are hands involved in the crafting.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I guess, what do you think differentiates Blue Moon from other Miller Coors products? You know, do you think it really is quite different in terms of what they're trying to do, both for taste and in terms of their marketing?
Well, I mean, let's be honest about things. Much of beer is marketing, and that is as true on the big brewery side as it is on the small brewery side. You know, there's a lot of beer that's being produced across North America today that is being sold with the drink local catchphrase.
Right.
And my counter to that as a consumer advocate in my writing is that drink local is a great philosophy so long as the beer is good. If your local beer isn't very good, I can't see a lot of argument in favor of drinking locally.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem that you see this sort of thing, not just in beer or spirits. This is something you see all the time. You know, big food companies emphasizing handmade or old-fashioned recipes. That makes me think of soup. So it kind of sounds to me like you think maybe it's up to consumers to wisen up rather than for manufacturers to be a little more forthright about the scale of their operations.
You know, you're never going to get producers to be completely honest about their lineups. I mean, the mass producer is always going to try to distance themselves from the artisanal spur line that sells about, you know, 1/20th of the amount, but gives them a lot of artisanal credibility. That's going to be the case with beer. It's going to be the case with spirits. And I think you're right. It is up to the consumer to say, you know, either this doesn't matter to me and I'm just going to drink what I like the taste of, or it does matter to me to the extent that I'm willing to read up and find out who owns Blue Moon and who owns these other brands, Shock Tops from Anheuser-Busch and, you know, these other brands that are kind of masquerading as small brewery productions.
Stephen Beaumont there, co-author of The World Atlas of Beer and the new Pocket Beer Guide 2015, speaking with Taylor Quimby. You may have known that Blue Moon is owned by MillerCoors, but maybe not realized that the company has previously been compelled to change how it describes its project. A lawsuit in the late 90s forced Blue Moon to go from being a Belgian ale to a Belgian-style ale so as not to mislead customers about where the beer is brewed. Who knew there was so much spin to be considered when you're popping your cap on a cold one? Red Stripe, for example, has a similar description. The Jamaican-style ale is actually produced in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. From customer service to filing your taxes to scheduling meetings, just about any task, from the menial to the monumental, can be outsourced online. But what about outsourcing a creative project? Can imagination be purchased online? Well, for his latest story, NHPR's Sean Hurley went to find out. By attempting to create and produce an entire radio drama, relying solely on a website called Fiverr. That's an online marketplace where people offer various services starting at just $5. Here's a taste of some of the services you'll find on Fiverr.com.
Hi, I'm Bea, and welcome to my Fiverr page. I'm here to be your virtual assistant.
I will transcribe up to 10 minutes of your recorded audio or video for only $5. This offer is only good at Fiverr.com.
Hi everyone, my name is Devin, and for just $5, I will create or refine your resume or cover letter.
I can help you with various tasks such as email management or maintenance, research, or product review.
Now, before we get into how Sean went about outsourcing a radio story, a little background on what inspired the idea in the first place. Just a few years ago, Sean offered his services on Fiverr, and for the low, low price of $5, Sean would compose, perform, and record a 30-second personalized song for any client. So who sought his services? Well, let's have him tell us.
I mean, I thought I was going to get people who wanted to put cheap radio jingles on the air. I would say 50 to 60% of them were just people looking for songs about themselves, about their boyfriends or girlfriends, or just little weird ideas that they had that they weren't going anywhere. So this one came in. I'll just read what she wrote. I want a song to contain something that involves an owl, a pink moon, the universe is our paradise, coasting in a toast of us, and anything else that makes it really sparkle, that gives off that lovish, gothish feel to it.
Well, let's hear what you came up with.
All right.
The owl and the old pink moon both wait and fly away. The universe, a paradise so small and large and bright. When the owl goes flying, the pink moon does too.
Wow, Sean, that's a lot of work for $5.
You know, I actually can't remember how long it took me, but sometimes songs take 15 minutes. Sometimes it takes, you know, 3 days. And then after you're done, you can't remember whether it was a 15-minute long deal or 3 or 4 days. But it definitely took longer than whatever I might have valued my time to be per hour. But I took her serious.
Yeah.
You know, I tried to
grab this
feeling that she was hoping. And I think that part for me was fun, was trying to capture whatever odd request a person had. Trying to give that to them was sort of something I was, you know, happy to do and try to do.
How many songs did you write for Fiverr customers?
I think about 60 to 70 songs.
That's a lot.
In about a 2-month period, at which point I stopped. I worked for 2 months, got to level 2, realized there wasn't the big payday. So, and over that 2 months, I made about $600, $700, of which Fiverr keeps 20%.
Which song did you make the most money off of?
It was a song for a company that makes chili for preppers. I made $45, I think.
People who are preparing for the apocalypse.
Right, right. So this chili that they have is shelf-stable for 25 years. And so they wanted a song that was fun, but somehow gets across the things that preppers might be interested in, the shelf-stable chili that is delicious and award-winning.
Let's hear it.
It never slips my mind, eat chili all the time. Chili like a tiger inside, chili like a fiery wine, chili. Inside Foods award-winning chili. It's all natural and non-GMO and is shelf-stable for 25 years. Chili, like a tiger inside. Chili, like a fiery wine. Chili, I got to stop and eat that hot sweet heat, oh, and cheap.
Oh, I think that's it. I hope so.
I hope the Grammy committee is taking note.
Oh my gosh, that one didn't feel too good.
It feels like a tiger inside.
It was like a tiger. It just a lot, you know, when you write music for other people, a lot of times it just really fills you with embarrassment. Not because, like, I didn't, you know, I'm not against preppers chili, but there's a bit of sales that goes into it. Whenever you have to do anything that feels like you're trying to sell something to somebody, that's where I feel like I fail.
Well, I'm glad you're in public radio rather than jingle writing business then, Sean Hurley. Yeah. Which leads us to your project. You decided to outsource an entire radio story on Fiverr from conception to production. Now, again, Fiverr is this website where people offer various services beginning at $5. So where did you start?
The first problem I had was I thought, well, what should this story be about, or how do I... To get the ball rolling, I didn't know what to do, and I was just drifting around on Fiverr, and then I found this woman, Nadia, in the UK, who is a psychic and writes titles for $5. So I thought, oh, I could get a title done by a psychic for $5, and that seemed like a really fine way to begin this kind of thing.
Title being?
Nadia's title, Man Manifests Cash Out of Thin Air When He Had Nowhere to Turn to, the real-life story of the power of providence.
Okay, so you paid your $5, you got the title of the story. What was the next step?
I wanted to keep out of it as much as possible. I thought it would be interesting if I did very little except sort of serve as the impresario of this, putting it together, finding the pieces, just picking the people. So after Nadia came up with the title, I thought, we should find maybe a writer of some kind to write an introduction that would further clarify where we're going. So I found a woman named Monday's Child in the U.S. and
a likely story.
Yeah. And so her gig was, I'll take your writing prompt and do something amazing for $5. So I asked her to create an intro to the story.
You got your introduction and then...
So it got me introduction, and then I looked for a writer, somebody who would sort of seemed exciting. You know, there's so many writers out there, and they have a little intro. Sometimes they'll have a video. They'll introduce themselves. They'll tell you what they're up to. And you're really just looking for a kind of vibe, you know. So I look for somebody who I thought could take this kind of weird title and intro and then proceed to write the first part of a story. So I found, the first person I found was a guy named H.W. Edwards. And for $5, he wrote the first part of the story. I asked him to, you know, take these two things, do whatever he wanted. So we did that. I did that four times with four different writers. And then I started getting editors. I started hiring editors for $5 to just keep chopping it down. And then I got tired, you know.
So the two women were from England. Where were these other people from?
The first woman was from UK. Mm-hmm. Second was from US. Mm-hmm. But it was a very international cast. But I would say of the 12 to 13 people that I used, I'd say 8 or 9 of them are from the U.S.
Mm-hmm. After putting this together, we're about to hear this story, but we're not going to hear your voice here.
Right. I am not in this story at all. I didn't write it or voice it or really have anything to do with it except for assembly.
Well, let's hear the story, shall we?
Sure.
Max Trenner grew up on a boat in the Pacific Ocean. As a boy, he spent his time fishing, swimming, and watching the sky.
I would lie beneath the sails, sometimes in the water, and watch the clouds. Not just the clouds, the sky too. Even the empty nothing of the air was for me very important. There was something there if I could only figure out how to see it.
His wife, Maddie, says Max was always a dreamer.
He falls down a lot. Like, multiple times daily, he'll just walk into a wall. Fall in a hole. Bam. He doesn't look where he's going. Drove me wild. It's why I left him.
Because he fell down all the time?
No. Because what's so interesting about the sky? Watch out for the wall, dum-dum.
Max is staring at the sky, but he does not realize he's about to crash right into a wall.
He didn't care, really. Just cared about his boat, a few rods, and that damn telescope.
With Maddie no longer providing her half of the rent, Max was evicted and left to fend for himself.
I think at one point I had $3.14 in my account. Not even enough for a tuna sandwich. And I'd probably caught the damn tuna.
But it was here, on his boat, with his telescope, that Max's life changed forever.
I remember I was taking a look at a set of real odd clouds. Looked like a big storm system was coming in from the west, but didn't look like none I'd ever seen. Wind started picking up, and all of a sudden, this rogue wave slipped under the boat and knocked the telescope right out. I didn't care about most of the crap Maddie took, but losing that telescope really upset me. Even worse, next morning I come down to the pier, and my boat's gone. Not even a splinter left. Just two holes where the cleat was nailed down to the dock. I just about cried when I saw that. First my telescope, then my boat. I had nothing.
It started with Max staring at the sky. Now he's lost his boat and wife. Worst of all, you know he lost his telescope.
Down on his luck, with no telescope, no wife, no boat, and nowhere to stay, Max went to work fishing off another man's boat. The meager pay was insulting, but allowed Max to survive another day, and using a borrowed boat was a constant reminder of his losses. His only comfort was in the quiet moments he was able to spend on the water, watching the sky.
Even though I don't have anything, I don't really have nothing. I have my sky, my air, it's mine. Mine to breathe and feel.
Max began to feel his loneliness subside, as if in the company of an old friend.
There's something for me here. I just know it. There's never just nothing.
Max fell asleep for what seemed like a short time, but when he awoke, he knew he was not where he had been.
You there? Are you all right?
Max was puzzled by the sound of someone nearby. He sat up, to find the face belonging to the voice.
Yeah, I think I'm okay. I must have fell asleep and drifted. Where are we?
If people knew the name of this place, we wouldn't be here.
Max scanned the frame of the young woman before him. Her clothes were tattered, and her body was dirty. Then he realized...
Have you been here a while? Are you...
We shipwrecked here about 4 months ago.
So there are more of you?
We've built a couple boats in our time here, but we never know when we're going to face bad weather. I don't want to risk anyone else's life. It gets really dangerous here.
You know, I'm pretty good at telling the weather. I've watched the sky for years. I think I can help us all get out of here.
Really?
I'll have to keep an eye on things for a while, but...
I have something that you can use that might help. It's a telescope of some sort. It washed up here a few weeks ago. Must have known you were coming.
Over the next few weeks, with his telescope back in hand, Max climbed to the peak of the island and collected weather data. Finally, on a cool summer's day, Max gazed into the sky and liked what he saw. He reported his forecast immediately.
So, you really think this is the right time? You think we would survive?
I can't guarantee nothing, but I've watched the sky for years. I know it like a brother. I think that if we want to take a chance, now's the time.
The next day, the shipwreck crew took off in several handmade boats. All of their lives counted on one man's weather forecast. After a week of mostly smooth sailing, the shipwreck crew could see the coastline. All of them began to cheer and cry, realizing they had made it home. But Max's real happy ending came later. Max went on to become a successful weatherman, the first of his kind, and used his job to help safely guide ships out to sea. His only colleague, the sky, who continues to prove to him every day that there is never just nothing. Especially when it's a wall.
Max is staring at the sky, but he does not realize he's about to crash right into a wall.
Well, there you have it, with a cast of 12 or 15 people, writers, voiceover artists, songwriters, all found on Fiverr. What is the name of it again, Sean?
Man manifests cash out of thin air when he had nowhere to turn to. The real-life story of the power of providence.
So you were just overseeing this process. What is it like for you? I mean, you usually create and craft your own radio pieces. You gave up control of the process.
It was nice, and it was a little strange, you know, because I felt like I wanted to rewrite the story, or I felt like I knew how to fix it. I knew how to make it. I could make this really short and tight, but I just had to not. And I was happy also not to. You know, it's nice to not. To not work and to leave it up to fate, just like Max Trainer.
Sean, thank you so much for accepting the assignment first and for bringing it back to us.
Oh, thank you.
And that's NHPR's own Sean Hurley talking about his completely outsourced radio story called Man Manifests Cash Out of Thin Air When He Had Nowhere to Turn to, the real-life story of the power of providence. You can learn more about the process and listen to the story again at wordofmouthradio.org. Before the break, NHPR's Sean Hurley told us about how he completely outsourced a radio story through the online marketplace Fiverr.com. And now, a story of outsourcing from a different perspective. Jessica Partnow takes us through a night in the life of Ali Jafri, a professional telemarketer in Lahore, Pakistan.
Lahore is a city that stays up late. So at midnight, it can seem like most of the city's 10 million people are on the road. Ali Jafri battles midnight Lahore traffic on his way to work every night. He works in a call center, trying to sell satellite TV to Americans. Ali says he's trained to neutralize his accent. He says it's all about the A's.
It's like grass in British accent. But in American accent, you have to extend the A. Then you'll say grass.
Ali's a dapper dresser. In the punishing Lahore heat, he looks fresh-pressed in a button-down shirt and slacks. but his face is tired and nocturnally pale. Telemarketing is a high turnover job here, so at least 4 years at it make him a seasoned professional. And at 34, he's a decade older than many of his colleagues. So when his friends Ahmed and Atish recently decided to start up their own telemarketing business, they called Ali for help with training.
There are a few tips about customer service. We can't speak rudely with the customer. We have to be enthusiastic, like this kind of stuff. And we have to build rapport with the customer. Then the main thing is product knowledge.
I'm a little surprised when we pull up to an average-looking house. I was expecting a bright, shiny office with rows of cubicles like the one in Slumdog Millionaire. We head for a small upstairs room. Computer workstations and headsets line the walls. It looks a lot like a low-budget internet cafe. Ahmed and Atish have invested about $6,000 in the equipment to start up their call center. Tonight's mission? Sell satellite subscriptions to the Dish Network. To find people to call, these guys just type names into whitepages.com.
We remember so many names, we watch movies, and if we like any name, we just put into the website and we get the results for it and we start dialing it.
Just like Hanks, Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks.
Ali, the call center veteran, searches for people named Johnson in his favorite state, Virginia. Ali goes by the name Jack Larson when he's on these calls.
Hi, I'm Mr. Johnson, and this is Jack. How are you today?
Ali never admits he's calling from Pakistan. He'll look up the weather report in San Jose or Newark so he can make jokes about the weather. Sometimes he'll say he's a recent immigrant from Spain to explain his accent.
Yeah, I'm Mr. Johnson. As I told you, my name is Jack, and the reason I'm calling, we are running an exciting offer in which we are giving top American 100 channels just in $9.99 only, and you will get free installation and free activation as well. So how does this sound to you, sir?
Ali paces excitedly while he talks into his headset. But this call goes like many others tonight.
Yes, American channels, with free installation and free activation as well. And we'll give you free receivers as well. All right, sir, take good care of yourself, but I really don't need it. What can I do now? I don't need that.
A few seats down from Ali are two very nervous-looking young men. It's their first night making calls, so they're searching for people with South Asian last names, hoping they might get lucky and get to speak Urdu or Hindi. Most calls are wrong numbers or go through to voicemail, but eventually one of them gets through.
Hello, ma'am, I'm calling for promotion officer Dish Network. How are you? That's great. Ma'am, can you kindly tell me which kind of service are you using for your TV? Is it cable or dish?
This is the night's one very promising call. But it turns out to be to
Dish
someone
Network.
Who's already signed up for the Dish Network.
So ma'am, are you in contract? Okay, ma'am. Bye-bye.
Not one sale tonight. And after a few hours, it's time for Ali to head home. Call center jobs are seen as a good opportunity here, a first step out of poverty. Newer callers earn a base salary plus commission, but Ali, because of his experience, works only on commission and brings in $50 a sale. But Ali really wants to find something else. Back in the car, he says he feels trapped.
So I have no other option.
Because I work in nights. And all day I sleep. I can't do anything else. I have no time. I need sleep. If you need sleep, you can't do anything.
Ali shares a four-room house with his wife and daughter, as well as his mother and two siblings. The next night, after dinner and before he heads to work, we sit on the couch in the dark during one of the city's many power outages.
What's your dream job, Ali?
Dream job? Nice question. Dream job. Wake up early in the morning, 5 o'clock, and go for exercise, then take breakfast, then go to work and come back around 5 o'clock.
He wants what he calls a proper career job.
I'm getting into the IT industry very soon, inshallah. I'll work hard and I'll get classes. That would be a proper career job. I can work all over the world, not even in Pakistan.
And one that would let him work proper hours. From Lahore, I'm Jessica Partnow for the World Vision Report.
And funding for Jessica's story was provided by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Oh.
Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org, where your subscription to the Word of Mouth Radio podcast awaits you. You can also find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like it, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.